Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well.
Well, I've got a spur under my saddle. Did you see? Now, we have to talk about it.
That explains the expression on your face.
We cannot be the Restaurant Guys and not talk about the meat recall, the largest meat recall in American history.
In history.
143 million pounds of meat was recalled.
143 million pounds.
And was this meat recalled because the USDA inspectors at some meat plant found something untoward? No.
No, it wasn't.
Was it because someone got sick?
No.
Was it because of some anomalous thing that only happened once and I don't think so.
Sadly not. Sadly, this recall is because we're sloppy.
Here's what happened. The Humane Society went into a meat packing plant and they took a hidden video. They went undercover and they took video of cows the way that, you know, I would assume cows have always been treated at that plant or have been for a long, long time. USDA inspectors were there, said nothing, did nothing, reported nothing. The video would seem to indicate this is business as usual.
Sure.
And what I think is funny is we have this big meat recall as if this is different than...
Right, this is different than the rest of the meat that's out on the market.
So what they found was... They found downer cattle, which are cattle that aren't healthy enough to walk to the slaughterhouse. Now, our meat regulations are so weak that you can actually get downer cattle. They can still find their way into the food supply, but you need to call a USDA inspector who might even call a vet, and that USDA inspector will investigate and examine that cow to see if it's really sick or just weak. And the USDA inspector...
Okay, we're not jackals, we're not vultures, we're not supposed to eat things that are dying, okay?
So,
we're not supposed to eat meat that is about to die. You're not supposed to do that.
So, but
we're not built for it.
But the USDA inspector can approve downer cattle to go into the slaughterhouse. But these people weren't even getting the USDA inspector. What they were doing was they were showing up with forklifts and very cruelly doing things to these cattle to lift them up on the forklift to basically bring them into the slaughterhouse, sometimes start butchering them alive, sticking things in their eyes, torturing, shocking these cattle. And some of it was just gratuitous. Some of it was people were frustrated that the cows weren't moving. And these cows, and again...
Inhumane.
There's no reason... I'm not saying it was business as usual, but there's no reason to think it wasn't business as usual.
Uh-huh.
USDA inspectors were on site. And this meat made it into the food supply.
Inhumane. And it is remarkable to me how, you know, people make a fuss when Jamie Oliver goes and butchers a chicken on television because it's too gratuitous for them. And you know what? We need to get closer to this process, okay?
And so
one of the things we've done is we've isolated ourselves so far from the process that things like this are commonplace and they're allowed to happen, but they're allowed to happen because we as Americans have isolated ourselves from the process.
Well, and they're also allowed to happen because large agribusiness concerns have the U.S. Department of Agriculture in their pocket. Okay, and in many states and in many places, and they have local agriculture departments in their pocket as well. We respond to all the bad things happening at huge agribusiness meat processing plants. Many state legislatures have responded by making it illegal to take photographs of livestock.
That's great. And you know what? So that's a great response. So this will just go away. No, what we need to do
is photograph it all.
Is we need to photograph it all. We need to have people taking video, going through the processing plant whenever they want to go through and take pictures and videotape it. And you know what? If it ends up on YouTube, it ends up on YouTube, and it should. And it's, you know, this is what's happening. That when we choose to eat meat, and I'm a meat eater, okay, when I choose to eat meat, I should know what the process is for that meat getting into the system. And because we were so, you know, grossed out by that process, we divorce ourselves from it. And by divorcing ourselves from it, the process gets worse and uglier and uglier.
Well, and look, there are humane ways to butcher animals. There are those who disagree with me and think that we shouldn't eat animals at all, and they're entitled to their opinion. But there are, and I think we can all agree, you know, animals are not meat factories. There are inhumane ways to treat animals, and there are ways that it's wrong to treat our animals before that we eventually kill for food. And it is literally the law in several states now, and they passed it under the fear of not after 9/11 that it somehow would damage the food safety of the United States. You know, maybe terrorists are going to take pictures of our cows before we slaughter them, and that's just nonsense. But let's be honest. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has twin mandates. It must promote the nation's agriculture and monitor it for its safety. Okay, you can't be the sales guy and the inspector at the same time. And the other thing the USDA does is they administer the United States School Lunch Program. Well, so what happens? All the, you know, a lot of this meat went to the USDA School Lunch Program. So we all know, we've all had our school lunches, the crappiest meat goes to our children.
We've talked about this before.
What kind of society are we?
We put the lowest level of meat suitable for human consumption goes to our school lunch program.
Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Connecticut Democrat who chairs the House subcommittee responsible for the USDA's funding, called Tuesday for the USDA to be stripped of its responsibility for food safety and let it be what it is.
I'm in.
And she says, food safety ought to be of a high enough priority in the nation that we have a single agency that deals with it and not an agency that's responsible for promoting a product and selling a product and then, as an afterthought, dealing with how our food supply is safe. 100% agree with her.
Speaking of an afterthought, one of the problems that comes from this system, the food recall system, okay, is it is a very, very slow process where the producer has to promote the recall himself, okay? That's the process by which we recall meat right now. Now, this isn't a toy. This isn't something that is long-lasting. The idea here is the longer the producer waits to do that recall, the more of that meat is consumed and the less they have to, quote-unquote, eat.
Now, this particular recall, I wouldn't be too concerned about this recall because this was recalled because after the USDA turned a blind eye, and I'm sure for years and years and years turned a blind eye, finally the Humane Society succeeded in an undercover investigation and got a camera in and then got the footage out. When kudos to them. You know, this meat is no less safe than the meat you had last week or last year or the year
That's
before
correct.
That or the year before that or
sad,
probably
sad but true.
The meat that's coming from the states that don't allow cameras, that where states where the Humane Society people could be sent to jail for bringing that camera in to that meat processing plant. We live in a crazy, crazy world.
We need cameras in our meat processing plants, okay? And let's do live footage of the whole process and let's have it out there.
And if that... And
let's stop people from doing these kinds of crazy things.
And if that grosses you out and you say, you know what, I don't want to see animals killed, I'm going to be a vegetarian, I respect your choice. And if you say, you know what, I, you know, realize that if we want to eat meat, we kill animals for meat, and there's a certain way that it can be done that's humane and natural, that's where I stand.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, yeah, animals are just meat factories that we grow meat on, and who cares if you torture them or kill them or rip their legs off, I don't respect that.
And I don't want to say just as bad, but certainly bad is closing your eyes to the whole process and not understanding it and divorcing yourself from it, because what we do when we divorce ourselves from the process is we allow these kinds of things to happen.
When we come back, we're going to have a lot more fun. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is Mark and Francis, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. We're talking today with Eric Felton. He writes the celebrated cocktail column, How's Your Drink, for the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal. In May 07, he was honored with a James Beard Foundation Award for Best Newspaper Writing on Wine, Spirits, or Beer. And he's joining us today to talk about his new book, How's Your Drink, Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well.
Eric Felton, welcome to the show.
Mark, Francis, how you guys doing?
Of all the major arts, the art of drinking well is the one nearest and dearest to my heart, as well as the only one at which I'm prolifically talented.
Yeah, it's the only one I have
lots of practice.
It does take practice, doesn't it? Now, before we start talking about cocktails, you're also a musician. You're quite an accomplished musician as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, jazz singer and trombonist.
And this is sort of a side passion of yours. How do you go now? Musicians and cocktails have a long and storied history together. But how did you come to write about cocktails?
Well, you know, I guess there is a similarity of interest there, which is the music I like to perform is jazz, swing, big band jazz, and there's a certain grown up aesthetic, if you will, to that great music and. Cocktails at their best are also a grown-up aesthetic, and that's really the kind of atmosphere I've tried to bring to the column and in the book.
Well, it's not just that. You talk about timing in the history of our country. Cocktails and big band jazz were popular around, you know, became popular around the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that that American drinks, which encompasses not only cocktails but really the whole concept of the mixed drink, whether it's a julep or a cocktail or whatever, is perhaps the first American art form, with jazz being the second truly American art form. And they came to their fullest flower really at the same time in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
I'm glad you put cocktails in front of jazz.
Well, and also not only did they come to the fore in the same time frame, but they came to the fore in the same places very often, you know, and cocktailians and musicians, especially jazz musicians, you know, we live at night, and you know, it's all part of the same culture. And your book is about culture, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and one of the fun things in doing a lot of the research that I've done for the book is I'll find the drinks that some of my favorite jazz musicians favored, and run across that sort of thing. So, for example, the great singer Billie Holiday, she liked to have a treble brandy with a float of Cointreau on it, very elegant drink, and very much so. I mean, think about the Thin Man movies that are awash in cocktails. This was a series of movies that got started right after Prohibition had ended, and so sort of drinking was all the rage, public drinking, that is. And the movie starts with. Once we first meet William Powell and Myrna Loy, they're at a nightclub, and there's jazz music going on in the background, and William Powell is there teaching the bartenders how to properly make a martini. And he said, you know, you shake a Manhattan one way, and you shake a martini another way, and you shake a Bronx, which was the third great drink of that era, and he assigns a different rhythm to each one. And so you had this association of cocktails with the popular music of the day.
Well, and now beyond that is the association with cocktails and the popular music of the day, and also you know, cocktails have an iconic status, and what drink you, and you deal with this in your book, what drink you put in a movie character's hand tells the audience a lot about that character. Don't you find?
Absolutely. And you know, of course the greatest example of this has been the vodka martinis in the James Bond franchise, although that had been driven not so much by what they wanted to say about the character, but by the fact that Smirnoff had a big product placement deal with the Bond franchise. But along those lines, the Bond books, the Ian Fleming books on which the movies were based, had all sorts of different cocktails in there, and cocktails were used to set the place and where Bond was at a given time, and also to set his mood, and they would further the plot along. So,
well, and also Bond, you know, had this spy's ability to order the drink that was perfectly apropos to the situation.
Absolutely. He knew, you know, sort of the notion of always ordering one drink and only one drink wherever you are isn't exactly the kind of, you know, sort of cosmopolitan mentality that Ian Fleming was trying to put across.
Not very Bondian, yeah.
Not very Bondian. So when he's in Paris at a sidewalk cafe, he doesn't order vodka or gin or whiskey. In fact, he says, you know, it's just not right to order those things at a sidewalk cafe sitting there under the sun. And, you know, instead you order what he called the musical comedy drinks appropriate to the place. And in that case, he orders an Americano, which was a very popular drink of the time, and also turns up in Bond's hands often, which is this terrific drink made of equal parts Campari and sweet vermouth with club soda on top in a highball glass with ice. Great kind of bittersweet drink.
And
the best.
A drink that's becoming popular again now. We're fortunate.
I have to say, I remember, you know, there's also a certain bit of coming up in a culture where people drink cocktails. I remember I'm sort of a wine guy, and I started as a wine guy, and now I'm a cocktail person as well. I mean, we have a great cocktail bar, and I love both of those aspects of, well, imbibing, as well as serving and making cocktails. But I remember one of my early mentor was a gentleman named Kevin Zarelli from Windows in the World. He's one of the foremost wine educators in the United States. And the first time I went out to dinner with him, he ordered an Americano. And I didn't know what that was. But it didn't stop me from ordering one as well. And I remember it was so bitter to me, because I didn't yet have an appreciation of the bitter, but I thought, wow, this was very adult. It must be very sophisticated. And I choked down the first one. But I order them all the time now. But the thing about
anything with Campari is an acquired taste, or in the case of my wife, a taste she has chosen not to acquire.
You know, we need to take a quick break, but I want to come back and speak to that very subject, Eric. I'd like to know what you think about acquiring tastes, and maybe we don't do enough of it, and why we might choose to do it. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and we're talking with Eric Felton. He's a well-known drinks writer, and his new book is How's Your Drink? Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well. Before the break, Eric, we were talking about acquiring tastes, and you know, most people will acquire a taste for coffee or maybe acquire a taste for beer, but there are a whole slew of bitter drinks, bitter elements in cocktails, liqueurs specifically called bitters because they are bitter, that take some work in acquiring a taste. And since I've acquired a taste for them, I find them to be wonderful. Why is it worth it to do that, and why do we want to try to acquire a taste to something that's not immediately appealing on the first flush?
Well, you know, just about for anyone, and the first thing that tastes good to you is something sweet. It's why, going back to the, you know, the Pepsi challenge, in a blind one-sip taste, the sweeter Pepsi would always win out over Coke, and then Coke had this nutty, crazy idea that they had to reformulate their product to make it sweeter, and it turned out that's not what people wanted.
And
because,
then we hated it, yeah.
Right, once you get past the initial sip, sweet becomes cloying, and so I think generally, bitter things are more interesting. There's a much larger range of flavors that come with bitter than with sweet. But you have to get past that first sip, and if you're not willing to do that, then, you know, it's like with wine, you'd be stuck drinking Boone's Farm Tickled Pink.
I think one of the most underappreciated liqueurs in the world, and or digestives, you know, having a Maro or something like that after dinner, after you've eaten too much, after you've gone crazy, is to have an Amaro or something like that after dinner.
Which is bitter.
Can make you feel so much better, and people just don't do it because it's bitter.
Yeah, it takes some getting used to, and but once you get used to it, you know, the flavors are just more interesting, and this is, I think, the case for food as well as drink.
When we come back after the news, we're going to talk more with Eric Felton about his book, How's Your Drink? Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well. We're going to talk about movies, we're going to talk about music, and we're going to talk about some cocktails that you can make at home, so stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC, it's 11:30.
Yeah. Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Eric Felton. Eric is a celebrated cocktail columnist. His column is How's Your Drink in the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal. And his book is How's Your Drink? Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well. You know, Eric, one of my favorite movies, and I think, you know, I'm almost ashamed to admit it now because it's so cliche, but it still stands as one of my favorites, is Casablanca. And in Casablanca, you know, the bar, you know, Rick's Cafe Americain figures so prominently. And there weren't product placements per se like in the Bond movies, but there were two products mentioned in that movie. And one was Veuve Clicquot Champagne. And the other was a Cointreau straight up at the bar. And I think it's interesting how, you know, Rick's white tie and you know, Rick, you know, he never has a drink with anyone. But, of course, when Victor Laszlo comes in, he sits and has a drink with them. Cocktails are signify where you are in the culture and what we're supposed to think about you. Now, we've talked about that in the movies. Do you think that occurs in life today as well?
I think it can. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about Casablanca. One of the drink references that is most obscure in there, but I think is is one of these kinds of a subtle message hidden inside a drink recipe request is, there's one point where one of the Nazi officers steps up to the bar and he orders a French 75. And that was a drink of World War One that was popularized by British and Americans, and it's made with gin and lemon juice and champagne, that was named after the French 75mm cannons that were used on the front. And here you have now, in defeated France, an outpost of defeated France, where the Nazis are coming along and sort of taking possession, if you will, of everything, including the drinks that were once the signature drinks of the military they've now defeated.
That's tremendous. You know, it's funny. I never read that into. I've seen that scene a million times.
I agree. It's.
But, and I actually knew the story of the cocktail, but I never read that into it. You're great. You should write a book. The cocktails. Let's talk about cocktail culture today, because some things that have gone on in American cooking and the American kitchen and American restaurants have finally crossed over to the bar. And where, you know, American cooks are using seasonal ingredients, and where American cookbooks or books about cooking are coming out with recipes and stories. And I think what people who are educated in cooking are trying to do and having success with is contextualizing food, is contextualizing where recipes come from, is sort of making, not just telling you how to make it, but giving you an idea of what this means to wherever it originated.
And why it was made the first time.
And an attempt for you to not, you know, mimic that, but to make it meaningful in your own life and in your own way. Well, we have a cocktail bar, and I know we have a mutual friend in Dale DeGroff, who was at the Rainbow Room in the 80s and was the you know, at literally the highest point of cocktails at the time, and I think more responsible than anyone for bringing back cocktails and cocktail culture.
Absolutely.
In America. And his ballywick, I think, was that he knew everybody in New York, and everybody wanted to know him as the barman. That's part of cocktail culture, as a barman. But he knew all these cocktails, and he would invent new cocktails, but he knew the story of where all of those cocktails came from, like the French 75. And if you go to places like, you know, Death & Company or the Pegu Club or the Flatiron Lounge, and you talk to any of the people behind the stick there, it's not just enough to know how to make a drink. It's a great barman or a host should sort of know the story of where that cocktail comes from, even if you've messed with it a little bit and made it your own. I mean, that's a recent phenomenon in America, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I mean, part of what makes it, I think, a necessity of a good bartender is you have to, you know, sort of understand where a drink came from to understand why it's made the way it is, and you know, to understand what the ingredients are, and then if you're going to play around with it, if you sort of understand what the drink was about originally, that gives you the knowledge you need to understand how you might change it by thinking about, well, this is what the original author of the drink was going for, and here's how I can go for something different. But if you don't really know what the original author of the drink was going for or the context from which it came, it makes it sort of harder to understand the drink and to put it into a new context.
The same way we treat food, the same way you treat a recipe is exactly the same way we treat the recipes for cocktails.
Well, and also, you know, there are a lot of recipes where, you know, you'll run across, if you went and you got a cookbook from the 1880s, there might be all sorts of things referred to in there that that people don't really know anymore or aren't familiar with, or, you know, are using a language that is antiquated. And if people were just reprinting those recipes from a cookbook from 1880 in a modern cookbook today, you'd get some really weird, you know, outcomes. And yet a lot of what's happened with cocktail books over the years is that, you know, they've just become these sort of vast compendia of recipes, and a lot of these recipes have just been copied over and over again from books from the 1880s, and every time they get copied, maybe every third or fourth time they get copied, somebody makes a mistake in the copying of the recipe, or one of the ingredients is no longer available, so they just substitute something kind of random instead. And if you don't understand where the drink actually comes from, the recipe can just be a completely out of whack and strange thing that isn't really what was originally intended.
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk about looking, because we look at old recipes all the time. We're kind of dorks and like old books. And, you know, when you do look at the old books in the original, they'll say things like, well, you know, a wine glass of sherry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, what is a wine glass? And it was sort of a loose idea of what a wine glass might be. But in reading those old books, you really need to sort of bring your own sense of proportion to recreate those recipes. They weren't meant to be followed verbatim. And like you said, some ingredients disappear, and some ingredients work
change over time.
Devolve. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you talk about grenadine in your book. We make our own grenadine at Catherine Lombardi, our cocktail bar, because if you were to use modern-day grenadine in some of the recipes in your book, and you point this out in your book, you would make a horrible drink. Well, why is that? Why don't you tell our guests why that is, or our listeners why that is?
Well, you know, once upon a time, grenadine was a syrup that was basically a sugar syrup flavored with pomegranates and other things as well, some, you know, citrus, and it wouldn't be just pomegranate juice and sugar syrup. But that was the basic flavor profile. Over the years, the one brand came to dominate the market, and that was Rose's Grenadine. And once they dominated the market and really had a monopoly, the product degraded significantly because it's oh so much cheaper to make it out of, you know, sort of synthetic flavorings with a corn syrup base. And the synthetic coloring and synthetic flavorings and the corn syrup base.
We'll talk about the politics of that in another show.
Well, you end up with something like, you know, that basically tastes like Robitussin. But, you know, sort of what ended up happening then is this is what people thought grenadine was about, and it came to be any drink that you'd see that had grenadine in it, people kind of roll their eyes at it because, oh, that must be a lousy drink. Well, when you actually try it with real grenadine, and there are, you know, you can make it yourself, or there are several different companies. There's a French import rem that makes a lovely grenadine. There's Sonoma Syrup Company in California that makes a pomegranate simple syrup that's basically grenadine that's lovely. You try the drink with that, and all of a sudden, wham, these are great drinks.
And the thing is, there are whole categories of drinks that use grenadine, like daisies.
And one of the things that Eric just mentioned, and I think that's really important out there, is it's becoming easier and easier to find these real grenadines out there in the marketplace and the kind of the specialty stores than it ever was before. There was a time period where you simply couldn't find a true grenadine.
Well, actually, and you know, one of the things that I found so fascinating is as you recreate these ingredients and bitters from another age, and I wound up making for a kid. We also make our own ginger ale in house, and I found that I made a Shirley Temple for a kid, and there was a little left over, and I tried it, and I thought to myself, hey, that's pretty good, you know?
Right.
Whereas you wouldn't think, because we think that anything that's sweet is just simply sweet and it doesn't matter. But there's been a revolution in this country in the last 10 years, but really more in the last two. And I want to talk to you after we come back from the break, Eric, if you'll stick with us, about the difference between a martini bar and a cocktail lounge.
Excellent.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. Today we're talking with Eric Felton about his book, How's Your Drink? Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well.
Eric, earlier in the show, we mentioned how Bond, in the novels anyway, would order cocktails or order drinks depending on the situation he was in. Is there ever a situation where a self-respecting man can order a pink lady?
No, not really. Although the Pink Lady is a great drink, but it really does fall hopelessly to one side of the great girl drink, guy drink divide.
You've got to whisper that under your ears, and then you got to cover the pinkness of it with your hand while you're drinking.
Ted Hay, one of the best cocktail writers around these days, he just suggests renaming the Pink Lady as the secret cocktail, the secret being that you're actually drinking a Pink Lady. And in my book, I suggest actually if you make a Pink Lady without the egg white, that you've got what is basically a gin and applejack sour that we could call torpedo juice. The reason being that torpedo sailors on submarines during World War II, they were drinking the alcohol out of the torpedoes, and the Navy brass didn't like that.
I'll bet they didn't.
Yeah, but the sailors, they knew what they were doing. There was more fuel than you needed for how far the torpedo had to go, so they would just take a little bit off the top. But so to keep them from drinking it, the Navy started putting a noxious red chemical into the torpedo fuel. So the sailors adapted by, they could take a whole loaf of bread and you'd cut the ends of the loaf of bread off and you'd pour the torpedo fuel through that, and it would, most of the red chemical would get into the bread, and you'd get a pink alcohol at the bottom, and the sailors called that Pink Lady in homage to the great cocktail.
Yeah, I'm not drinking that. I'm a drinker, but I don't
care how long you put me for two things. I don't care how long you put me on a submarine. I'm not drinking the noxious fuel. And the second thing is, I want my torpedoes to go as far as they possibly can.
If they need extra juice, just to make sure, I'm leaving it in the torpedo. Now, the other thing about you mentioned the Ted Haig book where he calls the Pink Lady the most often wrongly made drink that there is, because according to his recipe, and he's done extensive research, it's just a version of the Clover Club, and there is no cream in that Pink Lady.
No cream. But what's interesting is that the wrong-headed recipes were being used from the very date of its invention. This is not a drink that that was corrupted over long time.
This has been corrupted forever.
It's been corrupted right from the get-go, and people didn't quite know how to use it. And so there were ads for there was a brand of gin, Fleischmann's Soft Stilled King Arthur Gin. Like 14 brands all on one bottle there, and. And they, in their advertisement, they said, bartender so-and-so from New York shows us how to make a Pink Lady, and they put this into the newspaper ads, and the recipe they gave was basically gin, grenadine, and cream.
Ooh.
Which is, not the recipe.
To all our listeners out there, here's the warning. If the Pink Lady is not on the cocktail menu, don't order it.
Yeah. Well, no, because we have a pink lady on our cocktail menu, and I have to say we don't use cream. And I'm going to respectfully disagree with you, Eric. I think that it is completely unmanly to order a pink lady made with cream, but if there is no cream, you can order the pink lady. That's my guns, and I'm sticking to it.
And perfectly all right. Although without cream, without the egg white, then I think I like to call that drink the torpedo juice.
Well, we just call it another name. I'll have a pink lady for the lady and a torpedo juice.
There you go.
With egg white for me.
And well, with the egg white, it's a little. it's a little metrosexual, I think, is what we have going, the metrosexual cocktail. Now, but let's talk about, look, Dale DeGroff was, I was a wine snob, and I sat down at Dale's bar, and we had met through mutual friends. We were actually in a lunch club together for a long time, and I sat down at his bar at the Rainbow Room, which is, at that moment in time, the center of gravity of the world for the resurgence of the American cocktail. And he knew I was a wine guy, and he started making me cocktails, and I was like, all right, I'll let this guy make me some cocktails. Well, I mean, he blew my mind with how complex and interesting cocktails can be, and he's still at the forefront of this movement worldwide.
I mean, this is 20 years ago, and Dale was just a revolutionary.
But now, 20 years ago, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, people started to get the idea that, well, cocktails are fashionable, and every third-rate bar, you would have a martini menu, or there'd be a martini list, and sometimes you could even order them by color. The blue, the blue one, or the red one.
Right.
That's a far cry from a cocktail bar, right, in your view, right, Eric?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and by the way, this phenomenon is not dead, and it's not at just third-rate bar. Well, I mean, third-rate in practice, but not third-rate in how they're advertised. I mean, you can go to very expensive, hotel bars, and they will have a long list of martinis, and the martinis are all one formula, and that formula is vodka plus a sweet liqueur of some sort, and that's basically it.
Usually a colorful sweet liqueur.
A colorful sweet liqueur. And so, what is a liqueur but some fruit flavor, sugar, and a grain alcohol base? So all you're doing is you're basically drinking a liqueur in which you've fortified the grain alcohol base by adding a little more vodka to it. So it's really just fancy liqueur drinking. Well, it's not a cocktail.
All right. Now, Eric, we only have a minute left, but I want to ask you something that I think you're probably in a particularly unique position to answer. What is your opinion? What's the future of the American cocktail, or what's the future of American cocktail culture?
Well, I can only hope that the expectations that people have gotten for food, which is, sort of nobody anymore would put up with mashed potatoes made from potato flakes. And yet still, even in expensive bars, you will go in and you will get a drink that's made with lemon juice or lime juice, and they'll make it instead with prefab sour mix.
It's unreal.
And, we have to get our expectations that when you go to the bar and you order a drink for $10, $12, $15, that you get something that is made with as much skill, with as quality of ingredients beyond just the quality of the booze in the bottle, but every ingredient quality, the same kind of quality and care you would expect from the chef.
Hear, hear, Eric Felton. The book is How's Your Drink? Cocktails, Culture, and the Art of Drinking Well. Thanks for coming on our show.
Thanks, Eric.
Mark Francis, thanks a bunch, guys.
We'll be back in just a moment. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
And his column in the Wall Street Journal, they started with their Saturday edition of the Wall Street Journal. And I guess I don't know why I was sort of surprised to find such a great cocktail column in the Wall Street Journal. Seems an unlikely medium for it, but it's great.
Well, and I think a lot of people are reading the Journal Monday to Friday and need to read it on the weekends, too.
One of the things he was talking about in how things sort of fell by the wayside in the 70s, and cocktail recipes sort of got rote and lost in translation, and cheaper ingredients or more available ingredients got substituted in. There was a book that sort
of shelf-stable ingredients, really, yeah, I think, was a big issue.
But there's a book that was, I remember when we started bartending in 1986, was a book that was behind every bar and was wrong about everything. And it was a book called Mr. Boston, the Mr. Boston Cocktail Guide. That had been
the Pink Lady recipe that I was talking about
with
the cream and the disgusting ingredients was from that Mr. Boston.
Well, those Mr. Boston guys were, I mean, if you made the recipes out of them, they were terrible. But historically, in the 50s, the Mr. Boston Guide had been a great compendium
reference
cocktail
guide.
books. And then our friend Anthony Giglio took it over a few years back and is the new editor of it, and it is once again...
It's got the real recipes again.
So if you look at the Mr. Boston Guide, the same thing happened to it that happened to American cocktail culture. Mm-hmm. And the drinks that are in it now are phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it was a reflection of the cocktail culture, not the other way around. I don't think it caused cocktails to fall down. I think that cocktails falling down caused the Mr. Bostons to start taking shape.
And also, I'll tell you something. I think that in most bars, you don't get drinks as well made as it writes that they should be in the Mr. Boston Guide.
I think
the Mr. Boston Guide is ahead of the curve, and I can only hope that we all follow it.
I think we'll catch up.
We've caught up. We're way past.
As a society, Francis, take it easy.
We hope that you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.